Today is Monday, December 7th, Pearl Harbor Day. We are at the Amelia Island Museum of History, 233 South 3rd Street in Fernandina Beach, Florida. The following interview is being conducted as part of the Amelia Island Museum of History's Veterans History Project in partnership with the Library of Congress. Today we have the honor and privilege of interviewing Mr. Owen Taylor, a World War II and Korean War veteran. Owen was born March 25th, 1927, in Trenton, New Jersey. My name is Don Hill, and I will interview the subject on behalf of the Amelia Island Museum of History. Also attending this interview session is Ms. Lynn Taylor, Mr. Taylor's daughter. I will now begin the interview. Okay, Owen, you went in the Navy on your 18th birthday on the 25th of March, 1945. Where were you? What were you doing? And what led up to you going into the service at that point in your life, please?
I was in high school, like everybody else, and everybody at that time just joined the service. In fact, they still had the draft on, so people who didn't get drafted, you know, went someplace. I joined the Navy, and on my birthday, I didn't get called up until May 5th is when I called, because I had my best friend's brother-in-law worked in the Navy enlistment department in New York, and I wanted to get a full high school degree. He kept putting my papers on the bottom of the pile. He managed to do it for like 3 weeks. So I did get my full high school degree. They gave you service degrees. I didn't want one of those. I qualified, had good enough grades, so they gave me my full degree and went in May 5th.
And you chose the Navy because you didn't want to go in the Army, or your friend was in the office?
My friend was in the Navy. My boyfriend, the guy who was my friend, was a year older than me. He was in the Navy. And I don't know, just liked the Navy for no particular reason. And it wasn't, everybody was conditioned to go in the service. That's what you
did. At that time, sure.
Now the kids get out of school, they don't know what to do. So, tough on those, but it was easy.
Where did you go to boot camp?
Sampson, New York. It's cold in May. I got there, it was supposed to be 10 weeks, and I got scarlet fever partway in my unit. Oops. So I was in the hospital a couple of weeks, and that they just invented penicillin. And I was getting a penicillin shot every 3 hours. I remember that.
Wow.
I remember being in a hospital on the 4th of July. The hospital looked over Lake Geneva, beautiful lake, laying in bed, and the guy coming around with a needle every 3 hours and sticking me day and night. And that, I lost my unit then. I went back to the next unit, and that ended out that I skipped all the obstacle course stuff because I didn't have it when they started, and then the other guys already had it, so I get out. I thought I was there like 12 weeks, looked on the record, said I was only there 9.
Uh-huh.
I don't know. Anyway, after 10, 9, 12 weeks, we get out.
What happened at that point? Where did you go from boot camp?
Then I got assigned to Rhode Island, Newport, Rhode Island Naval Training Station, I believe the official title is. And I didn't know it at the time, but the Kearsarge was launched when I was in that training station, and I guess I was assigned to the Kearsarge. I don't remember it, but we were there. We had training, you know, recognized airplanes, and just living in the thing, having weekend liberty. Went to New York, where you came home weekends, and came back and be there at 8 o'clock Monday morning.
Was that a specific school, like airmen?
I don't know. A general training school.
The Naval, more general than specific.
I guess. And I didn't know it, I was assigned to the Kearsarge. I remember I volunteered for both the PT service and the submarine service. I got accepted as an alternate in the PT, and then I don't know what happened. I didn't get called, so I was assigned to the Kearsarge.
Which was a brand new ship at that
brand
point.
Brand new ship. I believe it got launched from Newport News. I remember getting on the thing in Philadelphia in the first of the year. So it got launched, and I say launched. It wasn't equipped. And that's why I couldn't figure out why I was in, parked off New York Harbor off Grays Point in the Kearsarge and making Liberty, getting on a subway, going to New York for 25 cents, seeing a play, you know, coming back. And then we were in the Brooklyn Navy Yard, and I remember being in the Navy Yard for not long. We tried to go over to Bayonne, and they backed the ship out and headed back in because the wind was so strong, the tugboats couldn't handle it. Backed it in, back in harbor. Next day we went over, they towed us over to Bayonne, had to take off half the mast to get under the Brooklyn Bridge. And then we were in Bayonne, and I guess in Brooklyn they were putting equipment on. I don't know what they were doing there. I was assigned then as a quartermaster, so I get to see everything and help, you know, drive the boat across the river. And when I was in Bayonne, apparently, my father and sister, they had a parents' day or something, because they came aboard, and my sister remembers it. That's why I have a couple of pictures. Now, she took me at the helm.
Oh, wonderful.
And sitting in front of the 5-inch guns. And that's the only pictures I have of World War II.
You know, but it must have seemed a massive, massive ship to you.
It absolutely was. It was huge.
Yes.
And then we went off to train in the Caribbean. And I think the records say that the date is someplace. Anyway, we officially went to the Caribbean to do flight ops, and they brought the planes on board, and we were in the Caribbean for, I don't know, until about 8 months, I guess. I remember two things while we were in doing training. One, well, we got to stop at Guantanamo, and I went ashore there, and we also went to the Panama Canal. And I remember being in Panama City, which is on the other end of the canal. We didn't go through it, but we had Liberty, went over there. And two things happened during the training. One, we lost about three or four planes practicing. And I was on the hangar deck when one went over the side, and he dropped down right in front of me. And I remember the guy was panicky to get out. And I said, "What's the problem?" Well, by the time the ship went by, the plane was down, and he got out. We picked them up. And the other interesting thing was that we were, doing a planned maneuver. We were going either full speed or flank speed, and I was steering, I was the helmsman, and the officer of the deck, who was the navigation officer, he was the OT. He said, "Left standard rudder." I did left standard rudder. We put what felt like a 40-degree pitch on the ship.
Sure.
I think it was something like 17, 18 degrees, but we slid a plane off the hangar deck into the water, plus a couple of guys that were on platforms working on the engine, rolled those guys right off. So three or four guys on it. We got them all. Nobody got killed.
Good, good.
And I don't know if that guy and the captain got shot or if it was part of what they're supposed to do, only they're supposed to tie things down.
Or announce. Aren't they supposed to announce a hard left rudder over the...
No, they didn't. Normally do it during flight ops. You're always turning
into the wind.
So
you were that actual helmsman. You really drove the ship.
I turned the wheel, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, it's fun.
I'll bet. What's the visibility like up there? I mean, all the photos you see, the gunnels or something about up to your chin or something, you know, with the windows.
Oh, well, no, you can see. But you're just really looking at the compass.
Anyway, yeah. It was a massive, massive wheel.
Oh, no.
It was the more modern.
I guess more modern.
Yeah.
And you watch the compass. And when it was rough seas, it was tough to keep the thing. If you're a good helmsman, you anticipated when it's going to move a little bit, and so you move it back and rather than, driving.
You know, that's a unique experience that very few people in the world have had the opportunity to be part of, to be the helmsman on an aircraft carrier.
Yeah,
that's fascinating.
Great fun. And then... Whenever you came into port, which you didn't dock hardly ever, but we had, I forget the name of the duty, you manned the alidades and sighted the bearings, so drop your anchor in the right spot.
Sure.
And flight ops was always fun to watch flight ops. Those guys, they had no jets then, they were all propeller-driven guys. The plane that went over, I think, was an F-4. But we had F-4s and SB-2Cs and Adventures on the ship.
Well, who was your chief on board, Kearsarge? Did you look up to him? Was he tough on you? Was he a...
I don't remember the chief. I remember the navigation officer, but I can't tell you his name. The captain of the thing was McKenna, and I looked at it when I looked up the stuff on Google.
Sure.
I didn't remember. Oh, I remember. He was McKenna. I have a certificate that says I'm a plank owner of the Kearsarge because the original crew.
Yes, of course.
And I think I got on it in Philadelphia around the first of the year, and then we did all these back and forth things. I did spend a week or two before the Kearsarge became available on the Randolph, which I never looked it up. It was a carrier.
Right.
In the North Atlantic, it was for training. And we went out in heavy seas in the North Atlantic.
Ooh.
And I remember we lost a guy, some young guy like me, standing on the flight deck. Not the top deck, the hangar deck. He got washed over. And
maybe on the elevator or something.
No, not at all. He was standing up on the bow. And I was up there like an hour before looking at the waves coming up over the bow and stuff. And you're invisible at that time. That little waves won't hurt you.
Right. Well, you went in March of 45. So
yes.
Now we're talking, I guess, after training and all these shakedown cruises and things, that the war's about over or is over.
Oh, it is over.
Yes.
I was in Newport when they dropped the bomb.
Oh, okay. So that would have been in August.
Yep.
Right.
Yep, Newport. And then I didn't get out until the following September, and I got out in time to go into college. I was smart enough to apply a couple of colleges when they told us we were going to get out, and I got accepted to try to get in Dartmouth, and then I got accepted at William & Mary, where my sister had gone before me, so that helped.
What rank were you when you came out? Were you like up to seaman apprentice?
No, I think seaman first class, I think.
Okay, good.
Yeah.
Right.
You went in as seaman, I guess. I don't
know. Yeah, seaman apprentice or seaman recruit.
Something like that.
And then?
You got discharged at Lido Beach on Long Island.
Uh-huh.
Had a big hotel, big fancy hotel.
Yeah.
That's a Navy commandeered, I guess. And
so you were home. You literally were home.
We were only there a few days before they got us out.
Yeah. Was it true discharge, or did you get transferred to the reserves?
I transferred to the reserves.
Okay.
And that's how I got to go back in the Korean War, because I went to William & Mary, and my physics teacher was in the Navy. He had been an officer, and he found out that I was in reserve. I majored in physics, so he knew I was in the Navy. And he said, "Why don't you get a commission?" And I said, "Oh, it's like a good idea, I guess, you're eager for learning." And he lent me his white uniform, and he's Lieutenant J.G. I went to Washington for 2 days, sometime my senior year. Took a bunch of tests, like all day, had a physical. And then when I graduated, I got a commission. And I actually went down on graduation day ceremonies. Strom Thurmond was there. And Truman, I believe, also.
Great.
Strom Thurmond had this beautiful new wife. You know, he was about 90 then.
Yeah.
And anyway, I got my degree with a robe on and went off, sat down, took off my robes, and I had my teacher's whites on underneath, went up, and they gave me a commission.
So that wasn't in ROTC. That was just going through.
Just one day.
One day. And then you off from there to OCS?
Nope.
Never went to OCS.
Nope. And that, I remember when I was getting discharged or released again, the guy told me, he said, "You never went to officer training?" He said, "How did you get away with that?" I said, "I don't know."
He probably wanted to send you back before he discharged you, right?
He said, "Well, I did. I fraternized too much with the listening guys. I didn't know that was, so bad." But, I decided when I got out of college, it was 1950, and I couldn't get a really decent job. Had one offer as a physicist now. I'm trying to get a job testing highway material for the state of New Jersey for not much money, as I remember. So I decided, I'll go try the Navy as an officer. And I enlisted in, I guess I offered a certain August, I got called up in September. They flew me cross country. And the first time I was on a plane, it was a Convair.
This was
1950, yeah.
The Convair twin-engine prop?
No, the four-inch.
Uh-huh.
Constellation, maybe?
Oh, Constellation,
TWA,
sure.
Four engines.
With the three-tail thing on the back. Yeah.
I remember that. But it didn't make it going across. It had to stop for gas in Kansas City or something. But it flew out to California, stayed in Oakland to catch a ship, which was an English freighter that was going to take me and 12 other officers over to Korea. So we hung around in the port for, I don't know, maybe a week. And the people on the West Coast, the Korean War was then, East Coast, you wouldn't even know it. You know, the West Coast, put a uniform on, walk in a bar, you couldn't buy a drink.
Wow.
So the West Coast people were into the Korean War, not the East Coast people. And we went on the English freight, took us a couple of weeks, and it's terrible food. I remember drawing chalk marks around my bunk to keep the cockroaches from, that was his thing to do, crawl up in your bed with you.
Did you take the northern route up around the Aleutians and then down?
No, it's kind of straight across.
Did you stop in Hawaii then?
No.
Just kept on going. Okay.
Going.
No more liberty. Years. You only got liberty when you were an enlisted guy, sounds like.
Right, yeah.
You
well,
know.
We were on that ship for about 2 weeks, and they had some heavy seas. We had water on the floor in the place. It was not, you know, not the best quarters.
I can imagine. Wow.
12 officers. I have a picture of that, I think. Anyway, we got there to Yokohama, put on a train through down to Sasebo, and then I was put on a tanker, an oiler tanker, the Miss Billion, to go catch my destroyer, who was at that time up at Incheon. And so we were floating around the sea there. I got transferred to another tanker, which I don't remember, but I saw it in the records, and then another one.
Like High Line across?
Yeah. Oh. That was fun. You know, I thought it was great. Heavy seas, the water splashing on your face. You know, it didn't bother me at all.
Good for you.
Yeah, it was just fun. Finally caught my ship. And then the ship stayed out. At that time, they set a record, 57 days at sea. We never touched land. We were driving up and down the coast and picking up bodies. We got up to Wonsan just after the Chinese came across and pushing the guys back down again, helped evacuate Wonsan, and shot a few shots in the land. After I got off the ship, those guys went back again, and the destroyer, this group of four in the destroyer, they called it DESCOM something, group of four of them, and we had the commander of the four was on our ship, and I get the fun of driving him over to the Missouri and once on harbor, half a dozen times.
And like in a whale boat or
a
launch?
Ship boat, yeah. You know,
right.
You know, and I was the guy leading the boat and a couple of listening guys. We'd take him over. He'd have a conference. I get to get some ice cream. Go from the Missouri. They had ice cream over there. Gee dunks, they call them.
Sure.
And then drive him back. So that was kind of fun.
What was your normal duty? What department were you assigned to on the ship?
I ended up being the electronics officer.
The electronics officer. So maybe your physics degree played a part in that?
It seems to me I fixed something. And
nobody else could fix it.
Yeah, they, you know, and the guys, the trained officers and stuff, they learned how to do vectors, but they didn't know the math and stuff. So those guys thought I was, you know, real smart.
Good
for
you.
Know this stuff. And they also, as being an electronics officer, I got to handle the movies, and which isn't much, because you'd get them from a tanker or from a carrier. Sometimes we'd also have a tanker to get fuel. And they'd send over, you know, the movies they'd seen. But I was in charge of them, and I got, you know, cheered or booed.
Yes.
Depending on what kind of movies.
A smoker. Everybody's in there smoking.
Oh,
and,
yes. Everybody's smoking.
Yeah. Let me go back quickly, if I may. Mm-hmm. When you went to, you chose William and Mary because your sister went there, maybe? Secondly, did you use your GI Bill?
Oh, yeah.
Good. And that was beneficial?
Oh, yeah. I got 3.5 years about from my service at William & Mary. And it was a different thing then. they paid for your books and odds and ends, and they paid you so much a week, I don't know, a month, you know, it wasn't, but it really helped.
It was crucial.
I would have gone to college anyway if the war hadn't been on. I mean, I had planned, my parents said, you're going to go to college, and I was key to do it, but this way it didn't cost them anything.
Yeah.
And I went through school, and then after the Korean thing, after a couple of interesting things in Korea, after we got back from Japan, we went to Taipei. The Chinese have been making threatening things about invading Taiwan, way back then, 1950. So we were sitting down to patrol the straits, and we drove back and forth, and we went into the harbor. We had a guy that went under the ship and fixed something in Keelung Harbor, and we had a couple air raid scares. And then on the way to Hong Kong, we stopped at the southernmost end of Taiwan, a little town, didn't have it anymore. And Chiang Kai-shek was tied up at the dock. And so the officers of the ship, this destroyer now, were invited by the mayor and his entourage to have dinner on the General Lissimo's yacht, which we did. And it was great. They had probably, four or five of us officers, I guess. And then they had four or five of the city officials. Nobody spoke English except the mayor, a little bit, I guess. And they were swilling down, those guys drinking down the hard stuff. I mean, the guy next to him, he just passed out and carried it away.
Wow.
This fish came out on a plate, fish that big, all this weird food. Great experience.
I'll bet it was. What was that ship again? That was the
Rowan.
The Rowan.
782.
How about your fellow shipmates on the Rowan, the skipper and the XO? Were they?
I remember those. I remember more my roommates. One of the guys was Lieutenant J.G. Don't know what his duties were. He was in New Jersey, and he got called back. He was very unhappy because he's a lawyer. He's just getting started.
Sure.
And he called him back and interrupted his life.
That happened to a lot of people.
Yeah, another guy I met from Oklahoma who used to catch rattlesnakes, his name was Lubach, and I looked him up on a computer about a year ago on the Rowan roster. He was there. And so I got into contact with him somehow, called him on the phone, and we talked. And he had gone back to Oklahoma and was retired, and he had a couple kids, and he was living on a nice house and not catching rattlesnakes anymore. Nice guy.
I'll bet.
So it was...
How about any troublemakers in your division on Rowan that you had to discipline or take to mast or anything?
No, I don't remember any troubles. I remember on the Kearsarge in World War II, we had a guy in there, guys who were part of the quartermasters. We called him Fingers because he could get you anything. And I know I lost my watch for about 3-4 months, and all of a sudden, I was him wash at the wash basin one day. Hey, that's my watch. He said, oh, see.
It was Fingers wearing it?
Yeah.
Oh, goodness.
He gave it back to me. There's also now a guy there, Art Josephson. He ended up going to Washington Lee, the tennis player. And they came to William Mary and played William Mary in tennis. In those days, we had the top team in the country, number one and number two rankings for amateurs. We blew everybody away. And Art came out, he had to play a guy named Fred Kowaleski, who was number one guy in the country. And Art said, it was like taking a tennis lesson. Fred was a nice guy, just hitting him back to him.
Yeah.
And I think we beat him 6-love. But that was, he's the only guy I kept in touch with for a while, and now I don't know where he is.
What'd you do for exercise on Rowan? I mean, when you're off watch, what was it, four section watch, three section watch?
And three, I guess, you're on, off. There's no exercise. I didn't do any exercise.
There was no tiny
there's
little.
No place to do it.
Space for a little, for barbells or anything like that?
No, barbells, no, nothing.
None of that, not like today's Navy, huh?
I guess, like today's Navy.
Yeah.
Plenty of room on the carrier to do it.
Sure.
But I don't remember anybody doing exercises on the carrier. Maybe they did.
How was the chow on Rowan?
It was okay. I didn't mind the Navy food.
Yeah.
You didn't get, any prime beef or anything, but I never...
How about rough seas on a smaller ship?
I have a picture of refueling in high seas, and the Rowan is underwater up to the bridge. I mean, that's fact. We probably broke off refueling because it was too rough to do it. We do it in rough seas, but not that rough. Really bad. I think I brought that picture. It's the guy, I don't know who took it, somebody who was on the ship. Well, that's a picture of it.
I'm ready to go if you are. You ready?
Right. After we left the Chiang Kai
Shek
good feast, if you will.
Yes.
We went to sign to Hong Kong to stand by to evacuate any U.S. citizens again because of the Chinese rather than the sword. We pulled up in a harbor and there were a bunch of the British cruiser there and some other British ships doing the same thing. And we were there and back in patrolling the straits back and forth. I remember going to Liberty quite often in Hong Kong. It was a great Liberty town. I even went over to the mainland and played golf on the Chinese, on the mainland of China, at a golf course up on the top of a mountain. And then the ship headed back to Hawaii. We stopped at Guam on the way to get fuel, I guess, from being in Guam, and getting off the ship, playing basketball, hot. Went back to Hawaii and again, I had a bunch of liberties. We were doing maneuvers off the thing. Come back and you'd have liberty at the Moana Hotel on the beach in Hawaii. It was wonderful.
Not a bad deal.
Now, then the thing went back. We went back to San Diego and did more maneuvers. I remember fishing torpedoes out. They fired torpedoes, and I was in the longboat with the guys. And I don't know how they stopped them from sinking, but we'd go out and drag them back to the ship. And then the ship went back to Hawaii and went in dry dock. Again, I don't know why.
What period was this? Was this been 51, 52?
So this would be early 51.
Early 51, okay.
Spring of 51. And then went back to San Diego again. And I had 10-day, I don't know how I got 10-day liberty, but I did. And I bought a car and I went up and down the California coast playing golf. And played all the good golf courses, played Pebble Beach. I couldn't get on Cypress Point. You know, all the other private courses I played in the Navy, and they were, you know, be happy to let me go out
sure.
in the middle of the week. Played Pebble Beach. That Babe Zaharis, who was there putting
the lady there. Golfer, sure. Lady athlete.
The best golfer at the time.
Yes.
And I played with some guy who owned a house on the fairway. He offered me, come back and I would give you a job and get out of the Navy. And I had dinner at his house, dropped me over to his house, one of those houses on the 18th Green. Very nice.
What was your obligation? Once you got commissioned, were you committed for like 3 years or?
No, well.
4 years?
The way I got out was because they came out in probably in the spring of 51. Navy came out with a letter that said, anybody who volunteered before some date in 50, which I did in June or July, whatever, could get out in a year. And I don't know why I decided to do that. I said, I guess I'll get out. Again, because my roommate was just PO'd. He didn't qualify.
Oh, of course.
But I was ill, so I said, I'll get out in a year. And a year was up, and they let me out in San Diego. Bought a car, and I drove across the country. It took me a month. Came back home to New Jersey.
Well, you should have been making a bit more money than your contemporaries, since you had the service. You had more time in service.
Well, I had enough money to buy a car. I saved it. Didn't spend any money at sea.
Sure.
I was at sea the whole year, pretty much. So I had the money, bought the car. Then my Navy days wasn't not quite done because when I got back, I got a job working at a Navy air rocket test station in the middle of New Jersey, Dover, New Jersey. We were testing those early rockets.
Wow. We
put them on a plane, and the plane flew out over the Atlantic and fired them. Didn't shoot them off, fired them attached to the plane. And I was doing instrumentation engineering and taking the data and stuff. And I did go to night school at Stevens Tech for a year, one semester. And going to night school and working just,
tough.
I wasn't hacking it.
Yeah.
So I decided, I'll go back to graduate school on my Korean GI Bill.
Yes.
And that's what I did. I applied and I got accepted at Purdue. and went back to Purdue and spent 2 years because I switched from physics back to electrical engineering, got an engineering degree. And the Korean year, I covered almost all those expenses too. So I really, you know, I get more out of the Navy than I gave.
So, and Purdue is one of the best engineering schools in the country, is it not?
Yes, it was, and that's where I met my wife. She was working for the vice president of Purdue as an assistant, and we had 50-yard seats. We had a parking space.
Oh, man.
It was seventh heaven there, going back to, and I really studied hard.
And that was 2 years?
I did 2 years to get my master's degree. Got out and was happily ever after.
Were you still in the reserves, though?
Yes.
You still had, like an active reserve or just
inactive reserve.
Uh-huh.
And in fact, I took some courses they sent away for, and they sent you once a month or 2 months. I did that for a while. Then a friend of mine I worked with, he was in the reserve. He enticed me to go on a cruise. So I went on a cruise that was a little destroyer escort, a little tiny.
Smaller than Roa.
Oh, yeah. We went from Philadelphia down to Miami and then back again. And we went out around Cape Hatteras both ways, and it was rough. And that was another one of these back and forth. And that was probably 10 days. And I got a lot of credit for that, and credit for taking the courses, and credit for being in the service. So when I stopped doing the courses, I guess I got married, got busy, stopped doing the courses. But when I had my 20 years, I applied to be released, to be retired. And I sent the guys a letter, and they said, okay. Along the way, I got promoted to Lieutenant JG, just for being in the reserves. And so I got a letter, and I got released to the Naval Reserves as retired Lieutenant JG. And I still have, when they have USAA insurance, they always call me Lieutenant Taylor. When they answer
same
the phone.
Here, yeah.
Yeah. And back in the Navy. So that was another good benefit.
Would it be beneficial at this point to talk about your VA issues that you spoke to me about on the phone? Could that be helpful to anybody who may hear this recording, or do you not wish to do that?
No, I can do. I have a letter. As I remember, they said there were 27,000 people like me who had been in the reserve and who did not qualify for all these benefits because Congress passed some kind of bill.
But way back when they passed the bill, didn't you say, like 1950 or?
Looking for the letter.
Yeah.
I have the letter. It took me 6 months to track it down because I'd heard about the new medical benefits. And a friend of mine said, oh, you don't have all the good medical benefits? And I said, no. And then I tracked them down, and finally I got a letter back. Here's a letter back from Vice Admiral somebody, and it's January 1994, and it's addressed to Dear Naval Retirees. This letter is to inform you about a change in the law that impacts you as an honorary retiree in the Naval Reserve, et cetera, et cetera. There are currently 27,000 Naval Reserve retirees like yourself who serve with honor and distinction. Are eligible for retired benefits at age 60. Upon retirement, you were issued the same DD something or other identification card. However, in 1990, it was Bush 1, it was in the and the Congress passed legislation authorizing additional benefits to reservists who are entitled to retired pay benefits and who have not yet reached the age of 60, a gray area retirees. Their entitlement was verified by the DD-2N Reserve ID card. Regretfully, honorary retirees are not eligible for these benefits. As a result of the legislation, the Navy can no longer issue cards and turn your card in, and sorry, we don't get any of the other benefits. Unfortunately, a new ID card cannot be issued. It said, turn in your card to the nearest facility. It's no longer valid.
An ungrateful nation, it sounds like to me, huh?
Well, they said they're grateful.
Well, I know, but
they took away our benefits. And the 1990 had happened.
Well, that's disappointing, but your service was honorable nevertheless.
And oh, yeah.
We all know that.
I didn't keep up. As hindsight, I should have, you know, kept up the courses for another 4 or 5 years, I guess. Then I would have had full retirement and had all this good.
Everything's so much clearer as you're looking back, isn't it? I mean,
but I've got no regrets. The Navy was good to me, as I say. I get more out of the Navy than I gave.
Well, that's sort of my next question, and that is how the Navy served you in your civilian career, you know, and your experiences and the people you met. And
well, I say it. I would have gone to college anyway, but who knows what would have happened. I would not have gone back to graduate school, I don't believe, if I didn't have the reserve from the Korean War. And then because I went to graduate school, I went to Purdue and I met my wife, and you know, then things just was one fork after the other. You just keep taking the forks. And the Navy was just a wonderful experience. You had no choice. I had a choice. I didn't have to go back to Korea. I could have stayed in. My ship went back after I got off, and the its sister ship got hit by a shell from the Chinese guys that was damaged. A couple of guys were killed.
Huh.
Sheldon, I believe it was, one of our four ships. But it was a good deal.
What happened after Purdue? You're married now. You have a master's degree.
Yep.
You have two specialties. You're a double E and a physics guy.
Yeah, I went to work for Thomas Edison.
Back in New Jersey?
Back in New Jersey, West Orange, New Jersey. And in fact, his brother was still alive, and he had his own little laboratory right next to the plant. Our plant was the old plant, six-story giant brick building in West Orange, and I worked on instruments primarily a sensor for oil pressure of Navy planes. And I did that for a year and a half, and then I went to, my boss quit, and I didn't like the new setup. I went to work for a company called Vitro that was doing work on as analysis for the Fleet Ballistic Missile, the Polaris program. And again, for the Navy, those guys had a contract with the Navy, and I used to go down to Washington every week and tell them we'd analyze their system, and done then with a slide rule and a pencil and paper and directing differential equations. And nowadays it's child's play. Our fire control computer in the submarine and my destroyer as big as these tables.
Sure.
You know, now there's a box like
that.
Yeah,
in your pocket right here.
That's right. And I did that for a couple of years. Then I went to Bendix, a guy who worked there at Vitro. It's good school for those guys. And now I got away from the Navy. I was on the Air Force. I worked on the B-58.
Hustler.
The Hustler.
Wow.
Before its time airplane, it was really super.
Oh.
Mach 1.2 on the deck.
Oh, yes.
And I got the flight control system. We had a mock-up in our lab. And we were just working on an automatic test set. Then using punch tapes to run it. And we had about, I don't know, 200 tests for acceptance testing, which we did with meters and knobs, and this test set was going to do it all automatically in a couple hours. Except you got to get every hole in the right place and have no chads. And we had trouble getting them out the door, and I was the engineering guy in charge, and the guy, the head of the factory, just wanted to ship them, you know. And you can't get to the out the door. He beat on the quality guy. And they called down the engineer, and I go down and tell them, it's not passing, you know, you got to fix it. But that was a good experience.
Where did you join Bendix? Were you in Bloomfield or some other?
Teterboro,
yeah. Yeah.
They just tore the plant down last year, I understand.
Uh-huh.
It's now part of Honeywell.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
And when these kids were little, and her brother was a year and a half older, we had the B-58 on the flight line, and we were allowed something like a week to go down with our test set and check it out on the flight line. And so we went down. I went down with a couple of guys, and we were working away hard, working nights and day. I told my wife to bring the kids down. They came down and stayed in the hotel. We were working 18-hour shifts, and we couldn't get the thing all checked out. And I remember getting called to this meeting with a couple of generals and a CEO of Convair, and they're howling and screaming, hey, you know, what do you want for me? We can only work so fast. It's a complicated system. We got this tape, you know, it's got to work. So they, I'll give you a few more days. And I called for help. And they sent down about five more guys, and we worked around the clock, you know, working on the thing. I guess they finally got it working.
Yes.
B-50 was a good plane.
Really beautiful plane.
A couple of bad things. You know, they lost the tail when they did an engine. One of these things was turning the ship part over. They had an engine chop at 1.8, and they blew the tail off, and the guys got killed. So then we went back, and we put the first redundancy equipment on the aircraft. We also flew the first solid-state autopilot. We took the tubes out, we put in transistors, and flew the first plane, Ship 31, I think it was.
Amazing.
And then we did redundancy stuff, and they put in, beefed up the tail, redundancy electronics. So it was a lot of new stuff. Then I got on the space program, and the space program guys said we had a job with Langley, the first manned orbital space station concepts, a steady program. But that led to us getting on the Skylab program. We teamed with Martin, and we took about 75 engineers to Denver, and I was the head of the engineering guys, and we supported Martin flying back and forth to Huntsville a lot on the Skylab program, got to meet the astronauts and stuff like that. And then I opted to try to stay in Denver as the program ran down, and I switched and we made a deal with Lockheed to work on the Hubble telescope. So I went to California on the company's expense. They grumbled about, and before the program was won, during phase B, I guess it was, and Lockheed won the job. So then we shipped out only half a dozen engineers, because we built a lot of the hardware for the Hubble. We built it back in Teterboro, and I ran the thing from California as the program manager. I spent probably 2 hours on the phone every day.
Sure.
And they did a Hubble telescope, and I retired before they got the thing launched, but that's okay.
Sure.
It was, there were studies before the Hubble run by Convair in San Diego called, it was just a space telescope. Then it was a large space telescope. Then it was the Hubble telescope. So I probably worked on that thing on and off for 15 years. And I came back to Teterboro as assistant general manager and had fun flying around. We had like seven or eight plants east of the United States and a company plane. And when my boss didn't go or something, he'd send me to do all the jobs he didn't want to do. And so we flew around to reviews and stuff like that, status things with the plant. It was a fun job. I really hesitated about retiring. I was 60-ish, 60, was I 62? I don't remember.
62
I was. And I said, I think it's time to retire so I can play some golf. And I did. So it was a good career.
Were there many military guys in the Bendix leadership or who worked for you where their expertise would have been appropriate?
We didn't have any.
The astronauts, I guess. Those were military guys at that point.
Yeah, they didn't work for us.
Yeah.
Interface. We knew all the paperclip guys in Huntsville. And my head of the marketing department was a very good friend of Von Braun's. He used to stay at his house and stuff. You know. So we had ins at Huntsville, which helped us. We would team with Lockheed and Martin and these big companies, because they would want us. We wanted to do their job. They wanted to do our job.
Sure.
But so they got to have us to help. And so we were very helpful in Lockheed winning the Hubble telescope.
Of course.
Marshall. And then we had a research lab where we staffed guys who were scientist types from the research lab, came on a program. We had lots of guys from BFEC. We got from, one guy I think came from the Azores. You know, we grabbed guys that were all out in the field.
Sure.
They come back for knowledge on doing the Skylab program.
Right.
We had tracking things.
Were you in Denver when you retired? Or had you, no, you were back in Teterboro.
No, I was in California.
Oh, California.
I didn't retire. I'm in California. came back to Teterboro.
Right.
I worked there a couple, 3 years, and then I retired.
And then where did you go? Did you come here? Was it the point you came to Nassau County? And if so...
No, I went back to Denver because we had bought a bunch of property.
Oh, there you go. Sure.
And we built a house in the edge of the mountains and built an indoor pool and played golf on a golf course there.
Yes.
We traveled Europe 4 or 5 times, Southwest, all over the West. And then finally we got old and decrepit, I guess, moved into an assisted living place in Denver, which was so-so, but she was down in Florida, and her husband got transferred to Fernandina Beach from Georgia.
How about that?
So then she came and said, why don't you come down and live with us in Florida? And we said, okay, my wife didn't like the place. I didn't mind it. But so we were happy to come, so we moved down here. And then my wife died after we got here a few months.
Sure.
But so she lives up the street. She takes care of me. She feeds me.
Lucky you, huh?
Oh, yeah. Daughters are wonderful.
Aren't they? I don't have daughters, but I have 2 granddaughters.
Oh, okay. My son's still in Colorado, up in Fort Collins.
Sure.
And she's got a daughter who's out in California. They're both in the music business, I guess. Popular music.
Good, good.
Young kids.
Do you have any other thoughts about your military or subsequent service you'd like to share with the nation? And
I would be for universal, for people who come out of high school to go in service for a year. It's tough to screen them, though. You don't want, bums in the service, but it's good. It's good for the people. I try to get my son to go join a ROTC or whatever. He just didn't want to do it. But I had a good friend who was actually born in Holland. He had to go serve with the Dutch army for 3 or 4 years.
Mandatory service,
yeah. And it's a wonderful training. I really, the guys now, they get the all-volunteer army. That's wonderful. And I guess the Navy doesn't have trouble maybe getting people to come in.
No, high-quality people, I think. Yeah. Not everybody, but the percentages are good there, yeah. I think. So.
And I'm sure you have USAA insurance.
I do.
And that's been, she has it because as a child of an officer, you get it.
Sure.
And unfortunately, I don't have it on my house down here. They won't insure.
I got it just in time.
Just in time.
Right.
Yeah. Yep.
All my insurance is with USAA, although it's not necessarily a part of our history program here.
And I keep money with those guys.
Sure.
Checking the savings accounts.
Well, if you think that's about it, Owen, this has been an absolutely wonderful interview. It's very, very important that we share these stories. Your story is a great, great story. Thank you very much for the service to your country. Thank you for sharing your recollections with the Amelia Island Museum of History. And Lynn, thank you for being here. The program appreciates that very much. And this will conclude the interview with Mr. Owen Taylor.
Thank you. Yep.